Okay, here we are. And we are going down to Las Vegas now, where it was... How hot was it down there today, John?
Well, it was almost 100 degrees, and the wind was about 40 miles an hour. It was just an absolutely, totally miserable day. And I don't know
really?
If there are forest fires going on in California or Arizona, but the visibility for the last 2 weeks is limited, less than a mile. I mean, ordinarily from my house, if I just drive a few blocks, I can see the mountains and I can see some of the hotels. Nothing for the last 2 weeks. Really bad.
I would say calling the mountains around Las Vegas mountains is a very interesting stretch. Very creative. I lived there for 3 years. And
yes, you
there's
did.
Not a
yes.
There's not a tree to be seen on any of those mountains. There's sand and rocks.
Also, hey, listen, you might not see trees here or people in another 40 or 50 years if they keep building here. I mean, Lake Mead is down over a third, and they're finding bodies on the shore now.
I know. I would expect them to have found Johnny Roselli, but he was found in his 55-gallon casket floating in, I think, Miami Bay.
Yes, it was. Biscayne Bay is where they found Johnny.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
you know, I was thinking the other day, and I think I've done this to you once before. For those of you who remember Carol Channing and her indelible mark on Broadway with Hello, Dolly.
Yes.
I've always heard that. Did somebody ever do this properly and dub in Johnny instead of Dolly?
That would be very nice. That would
Come on.
Be, yeah, that would
All right,
be
now,
very
for those,
nice.
For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, here's Carol Channing singing Hello, Dolly. Now, I want you to just plug into your mind when she says Dolly, think Johnny, and this is perfect.
And just imagine that Johnny is being sung by Rod Stewart, who sounds just like her.
God, funny. Here.
Hello, Harry. Well, hello, Louie. It's so nice to be back home where I belong. You're looking swell, Manny. I can tell, Danny. You're still glowing, you're still crowing.
Everything but Johnny.
Still growing strong. I feel the room swaying for the band's playing one of my old favorite songs from way back when. So bridge that gap, fellas. Find me an empty lap, fellas. Dolly'll never go away again.
Hello.
You're looking swell,
well, you
Johnny.
Know, it's serendipity every time you and I talk. Now, that, Carol Channing, that is wonderful. Well, you know, years and years ago, Bette Midler was signed to play in the film or on Broadway again. And Carol Channing's publicist was... my publicist for a while, his name is Harlan Ball, and I had him on one of my talking movies, and oh my God, he told the greatest stories about these people. In any event, about when Bette Midler was signed to do Hello, Dolly, she called Harlan, and she said, Harlan, oh my God, I just idolize Carol Channing, and I know you two are friends. Could I have a cup of coffee or something with her? Because I'm getting ready to do the show. And so Harlan arranged not only a cup of coffee, the two ladies got along so fantastic that they spent two whole days together. And Bette Midler, now she's a real star, she hugs Harlan and says, I owe you one, and that's 25 years ago. Harlan has never asked her for a favor. And guess what? He called her and he said, you know, the best show on the internet about movies is my friend Johnny Barber's, and it's called Talking Movies. Now, get a load of this. There have been, you remember Richard Dreyfuss?
Sure.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful actor. Goodbye Girl. Yeah. And Close Encounters, I mean, he was really good. For 3 years, he and I were best friends. And
when I had Jaws.
Jaws with Robert Shaw. And the thing is, when I had my local show on Channel 13, he called to come on the show. And one night he said to me, you know what, I'll get you a part in a movie if you let me take over as a host one night. He always thought it would be nice to host a show. So when I started Talking Movies, you'll know that when somebody who is not really famous like yours truly requests it, even though they have a top of the, I mean, Harlan, Harlan Ball is one of the leading publicists in show business, knows everybody. Well, they send out requests to the agents and to the publicists, and they never get to the agents or the publicists because there is no money if you're appearing on Johnny Barber's show. So they have all said no. Well, when he sent one for Richard Dreyfuss, I said, well, find his home Gmail. You can do that and send it to him. And it never got to him. It went to his agent. They asked for $7,000 to come on my show. And the same thing happened with Bette Midler. He sent a request first to her publicist and agent, of course, and they replied that she's very busy and can't do it. So Harlan just picked up the phone and said, honey, and then she called the agent, the publicist, and chewed them out and said, listen, I owe Harlan one, and I want to go on with Johnny, so she's going to be on the show.
Oh, that's fabulous. You know,
wonderful?
That's great. When is that going to happen?
Well, this coming Tuesday. I mean, you know, just amazing. Have you ever heard of a guy named George Fox, musician?
I don't think so.
Have you ever heard the song "Killing Me Softly with Kindness"?
Yes.
He wrote that. And not only that, he wrote the theme songs to Love Boat and Wonder Woman and Laverne and Shirley, a dozen of the most popular shows in the 70s. He wrote the theme song and he wrote the music to at least 25 films, and he's going to be on the show on Tuesday. He wants to do the show because I made a comment one day on the air about some movies would not exist. I mean, Psycho would not exist without the music in the shower scene.
Oh, you got that right.
Shocker. And you know what'll happen because I've asked for Oliver Stone half a dozen times. They don't even respond anymore. And I've asked for a couple of really big directors and writers, and they've all turned me down because they remember my reviews. So they won't come on.
Well, they're lost.
Show.
That's pretty damned infantile. So she'll be on next week, John?
No. We'll be taping her in a couple of weeks, but the thing is, once she comes on, it'll open the door to just a lot of very famous people who have done really great work in films, and she's done some fabulous films.
She, Bette Midler alone could book you for a year.
You know, I was booked at one time to be Paul Williams' opening act at the Universal Amphitheater, and so I wanted to go to the amphitheater to see what it was like, and it was in the mid-70s, and Bette Midler was the performer, and she just packed the place, and she was singing a song, it might have been Around the World in 80 Days, or Around the World, I'm Searching for You, or something like that. And she stopped in the middle of the song. And she says, you know, there's no effing place in the world that's sane or safe. And she said that in the 70s. And it's worse now. And I fell in love with her at that moment, you know.
Well, let me tell you a little bit. May I tell you my little Bette Midler story?
You certainly may. It's your show.
Oh, that's right. Never mind. I always forget when you're on. I was in a movie with Bette.
You're kidding.
No. I had a little tiny part, but it was a talking part. And it was, the movie was directed, the last film to be directed by Don Siegel.
Oh, my God.
Who did the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers in dozens of films. He suffered a heart attack almost at the end of production, and I talked to him, and I played a newsman, and when Bette Midler was walking around in Levi's makes pants, Levi's also makes little jackets, okay? They have, it's like a Levi jacket, a denim jacket, and Bette Midler had a denim jacket on. And it was kind of frayed and torn, and she came up to me and introduced herself or something, I forget what. And she grabbed with both hands, both lapels or sides of this jacket, and pulled it open and flashed me.
It sounds like her.
I was speechless. And not to mention incredulous.
You were very, very handsome, you know. That picture of you with the Muhammad Ali, you were a very, very handsome young
man.
Well,
time does things. But anyway, I did this scenes with her in the movie and got to meet Don Siegel, and she was wonderful. My mother was the editor-in-chief of Architectural Digest for 37 years, I think. And Bette loved, that was her favorite magazine. So we had a really fun time.
Oh, and, how interesting.
Yeah,
wow.
it was good. Anyway,
well,
that's my
I got...
I wish you could tell her hello for me. She won't remember, but the movie was called Jinxed. And I played the newsman.
Listen, believe me, I will remember to tell her. I can tell you, can I tell you a couple of little stories about me as an extra in in a couple of movies. I was working in the mailroom. Huh? What?
I've heard the mailroom story before. Yes.
Well, there are a couple of them, but we had this was in the 50s. And we had a German guy who was balding, in middle 30s, thick accent, who seemed to know absolutely everybody in the business. I mean, he would be getting phone calls at the mailroom from top directors and top writers and stuff like that. And one day he said, John, you want to be actor, yeah? And I said, yes, but I said, listen, I can't tell anybody that I want to do that and working in the mailroom because he'll fire me immediately. And he said, what about some extra work outside Paramount? And I said, oh, my God, that would be fun. So he got me my first one. It was... with James Cagney and Doris Day. Do you remember that film?
What was the name of it?
Oh my God! It's based on a true story.
Hold on,
Oh my God! Based on a true story. I think Cagney was nominated for an Academy Award.
All right. Are you Love Me or Leave Me?
Love Me or Leave Me. So I was supposed to be, you know, somebody who was really enthusiastic about her performance. Well, I didn't have to pretend. I was just so thrilled to be there. But the interesting thing about Cagney, during the breaks, he would go backstage or off the stage, gather up a couple of the carpenters and set designers and plumbers. They would put up a table and they would play poker for quarters. And he was so happy playing this with these guys who also contribute to making the movies. A couple of times he would look over at me and, you know, put up his thumb and say, "Hi, kid." And, oh, my God, it was thrilling for me. But the other one that I got into trouble with was a movie called Trial. And it had Glenn Ford in it. Mm-hmm. And it was about some a Puerto Rican or Mexican kid who supposedly raped a girl in a Santa Monica school. And that the kid was in the school being saved by Glenn Ford for the American way, right? And there was a crowd of about 500 people with a huge telephone pole battering the front door to get in to get the blood of the Puerto Rican. And we started at 7 o'clock in the morning. We were still battering at noontime. That was 5 hours, and everybody was starting to complain. And nobody said anything. And so finally, I stepped down into the opening on the below the steps all by myself, and I raised my hand. And the assistant director said, "What the hell are you doing? What's your name?" And I hollered, "John Barber." He said, "What are you doing stopping like that?" I said, "Well, when do we eat?" Now, I thought I would be getting cheers from the and it was dead. It was dead silence. And so he says, "You know, I'll tell you when you're going to eat. Now, we're going to reload. You're going to hold your position, so we're going to move the cameras from the front door to the top of the school. So we wait 45 minutes while they move all the cameras to the very top of the school." And then the assistant director says, "Okay, extras," that's what he calls us, "already back into position and repeat this morning's action." So we start battering the door and screaming for Mexican blood. And I'm hollering and I'm really angry. Now it gets to be about 1:30. And it's like it's the same damn shot. I don't understand. So all of a sudden, I'm telling you, the people I'm with, they're cussing now. So now I figure I'm going to get support. And I raise my hand and I walk down. And I wave, and I stop everything, literally stop it. And I'm standing again in the same spot. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Am I hungry yet?" Everybody, including the director, howled. And the director, Mark Rosen, said, "Lunch." So as I was leaving to go get lunch, Glenn Ford was sitting with his co-star. Yeah. And I looked over at him, and he put his finger up in his thumbs up, "V for victory." And they both had big smiles on their face. And I thought, God, I just love show business.
That's funny. You had to have done it just right, or it wouldn't have worked. Your timing must have
been impeccable. I know. But just, you know, sometimes I just cannot keep my mouth shut, you know. But I thought I was going to have huge support. I only had support the second time because then everybody thought it was
Well, they
funny.
Were, no, you broke the ice. They were ready. That's
there
funny.
You go. So I remembered, did you get the three clips that I sent you, because we talked about them last month, and of course we'd run out of show, and the first one, can we play it if I introduce it?
Oh, if you send me another $20 like you did last year, sure.
It was when I was on with Sinatra, and because this will lead to a great story about Carson.
We're not going to do a break, Todd. Thanks. We're going to keep going here.
Just 2 minutes about words first.
Yeah. Now here's fun. Okay. This is a fun thing. If you all do a search on YouTube for John Barber record album, and it's the title of it is I Met a Man I Didn't Like. You'll see the cover. And I must protest. The cover. The demon barber of Las Vegas Boulevard is standing there with a straight razor and a basket full of heads. That's not you. What the hell is that?
Well, listen, speaking of that, you know, I've had a lot of my stuff stolen by others who have websites, especially the original Garrison Saves. And so we've sent them about 100 copyright claims, and they're all successful to take them down. But I had forgotten about my first album called It's Tough to Be White, and somebody put it up on his site 2 weeks ago, and I had forgotten I even had it. And I wanted to listen to the first couple of lines. I ended up listening to the whole thing, and some of it was so good. I can tell you a funny story about David Susskind and how I got the title and why I did It's Tough to Be White. But I called my webmaster and I said, listen, let him keep it there. And you wouldn't believe this. I go to the golf course every single afternoon to play 9 holes. The number of people who stop me to quote me lines from that album. But with Sinatra, the 2 minute piece that you're about to play, which also I did with him on the Tonight Show, was his favorite. So if you have it,
I got it. All right, here we go, ladies and gentlemen. I Met a Man I Didn't Like with John.
Have you ever noticed that during moments of crisis, the news never talks English? That's one of the reasons that problems don't go away in this country, is that when a problem becomes a crisis, the government doesn't try to change the problem. What they do is they change the problem's name so that when we hear it on the news, it doesn't sound like it's a problem anymore. There are 40 million people in this country who can be classified as poor, but they're not called the poor anymore. Now they're referred to as the limited income group. How would that sound in the Bible? Blessed be the limited income group. A panhandler is no longer called a bum. Now he's disenfranchised.
That's right.
And if you have a child who fails in school, he's no longer a failure. Now he's an underachiever.
You could have made this last week.
The more he fails, the higher he underachieves. So you couldn't say something like a poor dumb bum's kid failed miserably in school today. You'd have to say something like, A junior member of the disenfranchised limited income group is a high underachiever. Sounds like the next J. Paul Getty. And we can no longer say that a man is impotent. Now we have to say he's a senator.
Very good.
Well,
senator
and
indeed.
Thank you. A little story about that. Francis really loved that bit, so he wanted to make sure I did it on the Tonight Show. Now, tonight, Johnny Carson had tried for years to get me fired, and he was unsuccessful, even though I had no contract. And the reason for that was, well, there were two reasons, because the first time he booked me on the show was June the 8th in 1968, the day that they shot to Bobby Kennedy. He still wanted to do a show, and I said, you can't be doing a show. And so we had our first tussle. Then that was the first really, that was the only big mistake I ever made in show business. But in any event, what happened is I did the show with Francis, and then it was very, very successful. Carol O'Connor was the guest, main guest. Now, when they go to breaks on these shows, like the Tonight Show, the band, the orchestra plays for the 3 minutes of commercial breaks because it keeps the people engaged and it stops them from talking. Well, sure. Carol O'Connor was unbelievably boring. Okay. So they go to commercial break and there's no music. So people just start chit-chatting amongst one another. And it's like a nightclub. They're just talking so loud. Now, when the 3 minutes are up and the band has a short intro to Francis, and then he introduces me, the audience is still talking. And I thought, honest to God, I thought I was going to totally die. And I go out there, and if you watch the original 8 minutes for the first minute, it's sort of quiet. But when I got to that part, I got an ovation, okay? When it was over, and Francis and everybody in the business, you know, he wanted to take me as his opening act, and people wanted me to come to dinner and play tennis and all the rest of it, all of which I declined because I just wanted to stay home with my wife and my son. So I'm out in the hallway with Sarita and the band leader. It wasn't Skitch Henderson that night. He had the day off. I forget the guy's name. Came out to me, and he apologized with tears in his eyes. And I said, what are you apologizing for? It went great. He said, no, because I was ordered by Carson not to play during the break before you came on. And I said, well, I really appreciate it. We appreciate that. Now this gets worse. So I'm so happy because it really did go so well. So now I'm back in my critics' corner on the 6 o'clock news. And the next night on Carson's show, he said, did you see John Barber trying to do a stand up last night when he should stay in his critics' corner? And they had to dub in the booze. Okay, and everybody knew it. Yeah. He was hammering me nationally, okay? So I dumped my review. I'm supposed to do a movie review, and I'm really upset. So I go on the air with Snyder at 6 o'clock, and he said, oh, my God, Snyder introduces me. And he said, oh, you know, I really enjoyed you last night, but evidently Johnny didn't. And I said, well, let me tell you my Johnny story. So he said, okay. I said, well, you know, they have a barrel, a small barrel in that office. And I said, they have a staff of about 28 people. And every day that they come to work, they drop a quarter into this little barrel. And the first person, that when Johnny comes in, when he's sober, which is seldom, and I said this on the air, the first person to whom he says hello gets the contents of the barrel. And the contents of the barrel is now up to $6,050.75. So I got even in my little way.
How was Tom Snyder to work with?
Well, you know what? I'll tell you what. Play the next little bit, and it'll tell you exactly what Tom was like to work with.
Okay. As I watched a couple of the newscasts there when Snyder was there, and Tom Brokaw was still there at KNBC before he went net, and they were just bringing Paul Moyer in. He was this big, gawky kid, and he
it looked like Tom. Paul Moyer looked like Tom Snyder, and it's
very interesting. Yeah,
because MGM hired two actors that looked exactly like Clark Gable, and Clark, in case Clark made too many demands, and NBC did that with Paul Moyer.
If you look at the thing,
yeah, their deliveries and everything were the same. But play this next little bit, and it'll say everything about it, and I'll tell you a little more stories afterwards.
Okay, all right, here we go.
I started on the NBC News, the 6 o'clock news in Los Angeles as a critic, working with Tom Snyder. Tom was the kind of guy that would come on and give you the impression the news was there to bring you him.
That's funny. That's funny. I would have called it the same way. That's funny.
I've been barred from three studios for some of my reviews. I was barred from Paramount for the first review of The Great Gatsby. I said, now I know why they're thinking of charging $6, three to get in and three to get out. I was barred from Universal for a review I did of Jesus Christ Superstar, in which I referred to it as Fiddler on the Mount. The most difficulty I ever got into over a review, though, was at NBC over a review I did of the Jerry Lewis Telethon. They call it the Jerry Lewis Telethon rather than the Muscular Dystrophy Telethon because someday they expect to find a cure for muscular dystrophy. At one point, Lewis came on and said he was there to help correct God's mistakes. You see, God built the world in 6 days, and on the seventh, Lewis told him what he did wrong. Anyway, the closing line of my review was that they had raised $18 million on the telethon, but maybe they could have raised twice that amount if every person who never wanted to see Jerry Lewis again sent in a quarter. The next day, one woman called me and she says, John Barber, I'm never going to watch you again. After this, I'm only going to watch William Buckley, because at least he's not opinionated. And one angry NBC executive came into my office and said, hey, Barber, could you do what Lewis does? So I looked at him for a moment and went, So he gave me a quarter.
That's wonderful. Wonderful stuff.
Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Well, you know, to be fair for the people who like Jerry Lewis, because, you know, it was going, Jerry Lewis was supposedly helping the kids, and it was the American way and apple pie.
What was Lewis's cut? I want to know that before we're done.
I'll get to that now, because this is true, is that in order I had a Studebaker, a Gran Turismo, and somebody shut out the windows. And Bob Howard, who was the general manager, had to hire a guard for me for a week. I mean, that's how people hated me. And so, to be fair to those who hated me, I picked 8 of the most vilifying letters that I should be castrated and all the rest of it. And I read them on the air. And I told the audience these were reviews about my review about Jerry Lewis. And I think it only fair that I give them equal voice. And I'm telling you, they were cruel and cutting. I mean, brutal. And I get a call as soon as I get off the air. And it's Bud Yorkin, you know, Yorkin and Lear.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
The biggest producers in, you know, it's
sure.
The biggest producers.
Sitcom kings, yes.
Yes, All in the Family and Maude and Red Fox and Sanford and Son. Anyway, he's kind of chuckling. He says, I hear you having some bad news. He said, can you come on downstairs? I want to chat with you. So I go downstairs. Now, Bud was known as a drinker, and he was the one at the time in charge with the Red Fox show. So he saw me all the time on the set with Red. He offered me a drink. I don't drink. And he said, I want to tell you how this started so that you can go on the air and talk about it and really reveal that son of a bitch. That's what he called him worse than that. He said, it all started by accident on the Colgate Comedy Hour. Now, you might remember in the 50s, the two great comedy shows were the Colgate Comedy Hour and Sid Caesar.
Sid Caesar.
You would just be a kid at the time. But in any
Diapers.
Event, the biggest stars on the Colgate Comedy Hour were Martin and Lewis. And the show was live. And, you know, Martin and Lewis, my God, they were the Beatles of the day. They were the Elvis of the day. They were absolutely huge. And the president of Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, that's 3M now, called the producers, and somebody in his family had muscular dystrophy, and they needed to raise money for a little more research. And they asked the producer, Dean and Jerry, for just a couple of minutes, would put up a phone number where they could call and make donations. So they went to Dean, and Dean said, absolutely. I went to Jerry, said, no, I don't know what the hell, what is muscular dystrophy, for God's sake. So Yorkin and Lear were the two writers. And they said, Jerry, listen, we'll research it for you, give you the information so if anybody asks a question, but just read the cue cards. So they did, and they raised so much money that the president called back again and asked them if they would do something like that once a year as an hour show. And Dean said, no, I am an entertainer. I'm not a fundraiser, but I'll help you in any other way I can. And they said to Jerry Lewis, would he? And he said, yes, but I need something for it. And the CEO of 3M sold them at 10%, just hundreds of shares of stock of Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing. And that wasn't enough for Lewis. I mean, it was like $1 million, and it wasn't enough. He was promised 10%, and that's what he got for the rest of his life every time he went on the air.
And that's 10% of the gross. Wow.
Yeah, 10% of the gross. So the year that I hammered in, he made $18 million. That's $1.8 million. So when I left, Bud says, can I look forward to seeing that? And I said, you'll never see it. He said, why? I said, you know, I don't want to tell that story. It's just too harsh. It's just, you know, I just don't want to tell that story. But I did put it in my book,
yeah,
and it's in
book,
more detail
yes.
in the book. And there's another great story in the book about how Lucille Ball accidentally got to own her own show, which I don't want to get into now. But the other thing that I sent you was the thing that I got the biggest lesson. It was Dean Martin's favorite bit. When I did it on his show, it was Merv Griffin's favorite bit. It's silly and it's nonsensical, but I thought about you because you used to be in Las Vegas. And you might remember the thing that they call the champagne flight.
Sure.
Does that ring a bell to you?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, it came out of Burbank Airport.
Yep.
And it was daily, and they would serve every single passenger a glass of champagne as soon as they sat down. So this was the little bit that I did about that, and that got me to be Bobby Darin's opening act at the Sands Hotel. It is silly, but I did it for you, so there you go.
Thank you. Well, thank you. All right, here we go. Let's take a listen.
Once I took what is advertised as a special champagne flight to Las Vegas. Yeah. Everybody gets champagne when the crew's finished with it. We were out about 15 minutes, I guess, when the intercom clicked on and a voice said,
"Is this the Swiss of Worth, this thing?" Good Monday morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Captain Murdoch speaking, your test pilot. At takeoff, our regular pilot opened the door and took off. She was a dog anyway. I'd like to welcome you aboard this exciting three-engine Boeing 707, which is fast becoming America's most exciting two-engine 707. Our airspeed is 600 miles per hour. Our altitude is 15 feet. If you look out the right window, you'll see a deserted Navajo village. If you look out the left window, you'll see the Navajos deserting. Bird, we just sucked into our starboard jet. So was the cat that was chasing it. Just outside Las Vegas, we missed one of America's most fantastic tourist attractions, the Hoover Dam. But not by much. We should be arriving in Vegas Tuesday. The temperature there is 61 degrees. The air is clear. And the sky's in a cloudy all day. Your stewardess will be by to bring up your lunch just as soon as she finishes bringing up her own. The others are busy reading Fear of Flying. Thank you for being with us, and next time you fly, be sure and take this exciting single-engine Boeing 707. Does anybody on board know how to handle a glider?
Well, they don't write comedy like that anymore because there's only one John Barber. That was hysterical. The voice, my God, could you mimicked it perfectly. That was wonderful.
Well, I guess maybe that's one of the reasons Dean loved it so much, because that was what I was trying to do, was trying to mimic him. But can you imagine?
Oh, you hit the tone. Several of his vocal tones you hit when you did that little sing bit. You hit his voice at the end, especially.
Yeah. And so I got a lot of requests to sing like that again, but I never could. I was afraid because I didn't think that I could carry a whole tune.
John, as I
like
told
that.
You, what, 2 months ago, you still have it. You still got that nice, round, full voice. You got it.
Oh, well, bless you. You know, it's funny because after last month when you played Walk Away and when you played the Obama Blues, oh, my God, I have one that I should put pictures to the way I did that. Oh, my God, you would absolutely love it. It's when Bush lied us into Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the theme song, the song, The Battle Hymn of the Republic, His Truth Will Go Marching On.
Sure.
Well, I called it His Lies Will Go Marching On. And I may have mentioned this to you. It was the year after I had won $1,000 talent contest in our golf group out at Prim. There would be 500 people in the room, a bunch of golfers. Well, I did a spoof. I sang about golf, and it was called to Sinatra's My Way. And I must say I sang it well, but it was funny and it was filthy because it was like a stag roast. But I won $1,000. So now we have George Bush lying us in to Iraq, and I am really, really appalled. So I write, I must tell you, these scathing lyrics about his lies go marching on. And I get up on stage, and somebody else has done, Bobby Darin hit song. Oh, the shark has, what's that? Mac the Knife. And did a really nice job.
The Knife. Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, I get up and I start to hum about the first couple of bars of humming. Like that. And people start to applaud because they think I'm going to sing something religious. And I start in, and they got so pissed at me. All of these people, these conservatives, all for the war, that they literally, five of them literally dragged me off the stage. And I kept singing. They took me off the stage, and I left, and I was shocked because I was certain there would be somebody there that would know that Bush was full of shit. He was lying. There was nobody there. They were all brainwashed.
They were all brainwashed.
And then,
wow.
But there was a manager of the hotel, as I was walking out the door, mm-hmm. He said, "Young man, you were right on." He was calling me young man, but I wasn't. He said, "Young man, you were right on." So, but can you imagine that, you know, because...
They grabbed you and pulled you off the stage.
Physically.
Unreal.
Yeah. Oh, my God, yes. I mean, they started doing about 8, 10, 12 seconds in because they knew what I was doing. But I kept going. And then one guy got up on stage, then another guy, and came to the microphone, and I pushed him away, and I kept singing. Because it was good and it was funny and it was true, but they didn't want to hear it, so
that's a thing about you. You have always understood what real humor is, and nearly all of these so-called comics have no idea what humor really is. They don't know. That was what I just heard on that album, which I've never heard, was hilarious. It's timeless. You know what's fun.
Can you imagine at the Sands Hotel in a day when men and women dressed up to go to see a show?
Yeah.
How big the reaction was to a routine like that? I mean, with just, you get 500, 600 people in a room. My God, a four-minute routine went on for like 10 minutes. It was thrilling. I still write jokes a lot, but I keep them to myself or I post them on Facebook for friends, and that's it. Once in a while, I get somebody who has to speak at a conference or something who is a friend and said, will you write me something? So I write it for them. But there is no one on television or anywhere that I find the least bit funny.
Thank you.
Or interesting.
Thank you. That's why I said that. I didn't want to go too far with it, but thank you, because I concur 100%. There's no humor out there. People don't have any idea. And what's really scary and pathetic is to listen to the audience laugh at that crap. Oh,
it's awful. It's absolutely awful. And, you know, HBO has a documentary about George Carlin, and in the book there are two great stories: how I beat George Carlin out for jobs, and he used to be the hippy-dippy weatherman, and he quit that the black comic quit. Oh Jesus, my friend, the guy that I wanted to be.
Pryor.
Richard Pryor, the way Rich and wanted to talk about something that was real. And so a few years into when he was doing that in colleges and schools, he was brilliant. But at the end, he got so dark and depressing, I couldn't even watch him anymore.
Yeah, yeah. We got to say goodnight. Go ahead and wrap it up. And look what happened. What?
Oh, no, just the... It was just too dark, and look what happened to Lenny Bruce. He got too dark. Next time I'll tell you some other comics stories. Anyway, I love being with you tonight. It's been a long time since I chuckled.
Thank you, John. Same here. I appreciate it. All right, you give Sarita a hug. Thank you, and we'll talk next month.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. The one and only John Barber. Be right back.